Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this LSE public lecture. My name is Geoffrey Owen. I'm standing in for Richard Layard, who's not well and couldn't come this evening. I have the agreeable task of introducing our speaker tonight, who I think is well known to quite a few people in this audience, Adair Turner. He studied economics at Cambridge and spent a substantial part of his career with McKinsey, the management consultants, staying there from 1982 to 1995, when he became Director General of the Confederation of British Industry. And he held that post with great distinction until the end of last year. And since then, he has, I think it's fair to say, a portfolio of activities, one of which is acting as visiting professor at the LSE. And one of the things that he's been doing since leaving the CBI is working on a book which will come out early next year, the title of which, I think I've got this right, is called Just Capital - The Liberal Economy. And it's out of his work on that book that he is going to talk to us tonight. And the lecture is entitled Social Choice in a Changing Economy, the Size and Role of Government. And he will talk for about an hour or so, and then we will have 10 or 15 minutes of questions. Adair.
Well, thank you very much, Geoffrey. As Geoffrey has said, the issue I want to consider this evening is the sustainable size of the state. I'm not actually, for reasons of limited time, going to consider in detail what functions we should wish governments to perform. And in that sense, I realize I have narrowed my focus considerably from the advertised description. So let me at least briefly state a set of beliefs on that issue, which provide the context within which I will address a somewhat more technical issue. The beliefs which set the context, beliefs about the appropriate role of the state, include the following. First, that there have been very good reasons why governments throughout the world have increasingly chosen to exit from direct involvement in the ownership and management of commercial assets, why they have chosen to privatize and liberalize markets. And also that prosperity and success in a changing economy is best delivered by that approach, by a rigorously free market approach. Second, that there are some factors at work which are as much to do with new technology and with the growth of the service economy as they are to do with much talked about globalization, which will make it increasingly difficult for governments to pursue the aims of what we might call the good society or social inclusion or the prevention of poverty through interventions in labor markets designed to create employment security or, for instance, through minimum wages designed to create adequate income. As well as more free capital and product markets, freer labor markets are an almost inevitable, likely, and indeed desirable development. Third proposition or background belief is that those freer labor markets and indeed product and capital markets are likely, if we take no offsetting action, to be accompanied by increasing inequality and insecurity, and thus that if you are concerned about those factors, the need for offsetting action is important. Fourth, that offsetting action could be achieved through the health services and education provision, the redistributive transfer payments and social insurance policies, which have been essential elements of the European social model in a way that the ownership and management of business assets have not been essential aspects of the European social model, but incidental aspects. And therefore, in a sense, the premise, the background premise of my lecture is very similar to the one which Kenneth Clark, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, set out in his Mace lecture of 1994, when he began by saying, "I intend to argue the merits of both a flexible labour market and a strong welfare state. The basic premise that I am putting forward, though not going into detail on the appropriate role of the state, is that we should have free markets, but very effective welfare state support to soften the harsh edges of capitalism." But that model of freer markets but maintained welfare states would be untenable if the factors at work, technological, growth of the service economy, globalization, if in addition to arguing for more flexible markets, they were also factors which made welfare states unaffordable. And it is therefore on that more limited issue of whether they do make welfare states unaffordable that I am going to concentrate this evening. The specific issue I want to address is whether there are constraints which make it impossible for European welfare states to be maintained. Are there factors of external economic necessity pushing us towards a significant reduction in the size of the state, whether we wish it or not? Now, there are many people across the political spectrum who certainly believe that there are severe constraints, and these quotations illustrate those points of view. First, from a Sunday Times editorial, "British tax levels must come down if we are to have a fighting chance. Apparently, we've got to cut them down not only to succeed well, but even to just hang in there in the world. A smaller state is therefore seen as a necessary condition for success in a tough competitive world, but with that fact, by the Sunday Times, positively welcomed." The second is from the other end of the political spectrum. It's from John Gray, the author of False Dawn, The Delusions of Global Capitalism, who, in common with many others on the left, shares the basic premise of the first quote, but in his case bemoans the consequences. Commenting on the need for governments to moderate the harsh edges of free markets through the interventions of welfare states, and comparing that need today with the same need in the late 19th century, Gray asserts that, quotes, "it will be harder now than it was then to moderate the social costs of free markets, i.e. harder today than it was in the 1890s. The leverage of national governments is that much weaker. Governments," the proposition is, and you hear this frequently asserted by people who oppose the processes of globalization and free markets, "governments are condemned in a harsh world of global capital markets and global competition to a race for the bottom, as the phrase is, which will destroy the distinctive features of the European social model." And that thought is then echoed in the final quote from Donald McIntyre, a journalist of The Independent, but he has a proposed solution. He says if business taxes are not harmonised, and he means harmonised across Europe, competition for inward investment will mean competition to bring rates down to the extent that even modernised welfare states will prove unsustainable. Therefore, he asserts, we must harmonise business taxes across Europe to prevent the race for the bottom, a proposal which, however, is always met by the right-wing, ultra-liberal retort that if we do that, we will simply make all of Europe uncompetitive in world markets. Now, my aim this evening is to ask whether any or all of these statements are true. My overall conclusion, in a nutshell, is no, they are not. But my objective is not just to tell you the answer, but to try to establish a comprehensive framework for thinking about this issue, for it's a vital one, but typically discussed in terms of confused theory and in the absence of facts. So even though I've told you the answer already, you can't go home yet. Those who believe that there is a severe external constraint typically make one of these four arguments. First, that global capital markets won't tolerate high tax and spend. Second, that high taxes impose a competitiveness burden on an economy, a burden ever more harmful in an ever more globalized world. Third, that high taxes blunt incentives to work and save. And fourth, that even if all the other factors did not apply, the reality is that the tax base is going to be eroded by migration and avoidance effects in the world of globally mobile capital and of the internet. I'd like to consider each of those arguments in turn. Firstly and briefly, global capital markets. Briefly, because it is actually easily the poorest of these four arguments. At least in respect to rich economies with stable governments, and I will accept entirely that this argument is not so clear in relation to some emerging economies, but at least in respect to rich economies with stable governments, there is no evidence at all that the pricing behavior and assumptions of global bond markets limit the sustainable size of the state. Sweden, taxing and spending about 55% or so of GDP, has an equivalent bond rating and bond yield to the UK, taxing and spending 40%, and the US, taxing and spending 30%. And that finding is not quite as trivial as it might at first seem. For if it were true that the other three factors which we're going to go on to consider were powerful factors, that high taxes harm competitiveness, that high taxes damage incentives and growth, that tax bases are going to inevitably erode, then the bond markets ought to be worried about the sustainability of Swedish levels of tax and spend, and ought to reflect that, if not in the rating, which reflects default risk, at least in the yield, which reflects also the danger that Sweden might at some stage need to inflate itself out of an accumulated debt burden. But they don't do that. Bond markets show no particular interest in the level of tax and spend. Their concern, quite rightly, is with the relativity between the two, and they treat these three countries similarly because they all now have sound public finance with surpluses rather than deficits. Bond markets, in other words, not only do not themselves constrain countries to a low-tax, low-spend approach, but their pricing behavior signals their lack of interest in the other frequently described factors. Global capital markets are therefore largely a red herring. The far more frequent cry of those who argue the economic necessity of the small state is, however, competitiveness. Nations are locked in a global competitive struggle, and high taxes are impediments to competitive success and thus destructive of growth. This assertion is, however, a product of almost total conceptual confusion. Companies are locked in global competition, but nations on the whole are not, for reasons which have been set out by many economists, most notably perhaps in Paul Krugman's book, Pop Internationalism, and which I will therefore simply and briefly reiterate the arguments. Nations are not in competition, first because the world economy is not a zero-sum game. There is no pot of prosperity for which nations are trying to compete. And second, because the use of the term competitiveness is completely meaningless outside the specification of an exchange rate, and exchange rates do and can and do move to offset temporary differences in the competitiveness of traded sectors, which are the only sectors of the economy where the term competitiveness has even temporary meaning. The prosperity of a nation is essentially determined by the productivity which it achieves in all sectors of the economy, traded and non-traded, an achievement which in general is quite independent of the success of other nations engaged in the same endeavour. The only way that the relative success of one nation impinges on the prosperity of another, that success relative to other people, i.e. concepts of competitiveness, can impact a nation's absolute prosperity is through changes in the terms of trade. By illustration, if the price of Malaysian manufactured television sets for some reason rises relative to the price of German machine tools, perhaps because Germany has lost a previously unique advantage in machine tools, then Malaysian success can make Germany less prosperous. But there is no other way, other than through the terms of trade, by which nations can be meaningfully said to compete. And the larger the economic unit we consider, the smaller the size of the traded sector as a percent of GDP, and thus the smaller the potential for terms of trade effects of any significant magnitude. Through terms of trade effects, competitiveness can be a somewhat meaningful concept at the level of, say, the Irish economy. It is totally meaningless at the level of the world economy, and it loses meaning progressively as we move along that spectrum of size. At the level of, say, the European Union, comments about competitiveness are close to totally meaningless. Those are the general points set out, as I say, by Paul Krugman and others. Given those general points, it is not surprising that almost all comments about tax competitiveness effects are meaningless too, specific nonsense within a wider confusion. They're confused because the whole concept of national competitiveness is confused, but also because they ignore two specific factors. The first is the real incidence of tax. Now, to many people, it is obvious that if you had a high payroll tax on employers, this must increase the cost of labour and thus hit competitiveness. But it is not necessarily true, and indeed, in an economy with an efficient labour market, it is not true at all. Provided labour markets are efficient, an important qualification which we'll return to, the most likely, and indeed in the long run, the almost certain consequence of a high tax wedge, a high tax burden, is not to increase the total cost of labour, but to reduce post-tax earnings. And that is, at least in theory, as true of employer payroll taxes and consumption taxes such as VAT, as it is of income taxes, where the point is more intuitively obvious. Taxes are, in essence, simply a decision by a society to divert some income from post-tax private consumption to collective consumption or transfers, and in economies with efficient labour markets, the impact is just that and no more. The fundamental issue for, say, Sweden, with a high tax wedge, is not competitiveness, but whether the people of Sweden want to receive so much of their income in transfers or collective forms, or whether they would prefer higher post-tax earnings. So tax incidence is the first factor which the standard story of competitiveness ignores. The second is simply the possibility of movements in floating exchange rates. For even if the tax incidence did not, at least initially, fall on post-tax earnings, but on the total cost of labour, exchange rates can move to offset the external competitiveness effect. And of course, they don't have to move to make labour costs equal between countries or productivity rates equal between countries, though they couldn't do the latter. They just have to move to make sure that the relationship between productivity and labour cost is equivalent, that Sweden's high labour costs relative, say, to Spain correspond to its higher productivity, no more and no less. There is therefore no reason to believe that Sweden's higher tax wedge will make it uncompetitive, and figures on current account balances at least imperfectly illustrate that point. On any reasonable analysis, the traded sectors of Sweden, Denmark, France, and the Netherlands are at current exchange rates highly competitive, running large current account surpluses, shown here on an unadjusted basis, but it is also true on a cyclically adjusted basis. Now, we should never overplay current account balances as meaningful measures of anything, but at very least, these figures should make anybody pause for thought before they start telling us that France or Sweden have been made uncompetitive by a high tax burden. And while personally I attach even less credence to the tables of competitiveness indices, which one sees reported in newspapers, it is again at least anecdotally interesting that all of those tables have recently been promoting the Netherlands, Finland, and Sweden towards the top. Practical business people, uncontaminated by economic theory, voting for those economies despite their high tax burdens. In general, the proposition that high tax burdens harm something meaningfully called competitiveness is nonsense. For clarity and completeness, however, we need, under this heading of competitiveness, to think about four special cases or special arguments. Now, interestingly, when we get down to it, two of these arguments have nothing really to do with tax, and one has nothing really to do with competitiveness. But since they turn up, and if I didn't mention them, they'd probably turn up in questions, since they turn up whenever this subject is discussed, they need to be dealt with. And three of them, even though they're not to do with competitiveness and not to do to tax, have some important policy implications. The first is union resistance to real wage effects. I asserted earlier that in an efficient labour market, the incidence of payroll consumption taxes or income taxes would in each case fall on post-tax earnings leaving the total pre-tax cost of labour unchanged. But of course, what if it doesn't? Let's imagine that a country has decided, over, say, a four-year period, to increase the tax wedge from 20% to 27%, that's 30 over 110, such that for those 4 years, post-tax earnings should not rise despite a 10% rise in productivity. What happens? Well, as long as everything goes to plan, nothing happens apart from that. A social choice has been made to spend income on collective outputs rather than individual private consumption. But what if instead we see trade unions resist the efficient market consequences of rising taxes so that after-tax earnings continue to rise as well as the tax wedge, with the total cost of labour rising as a result faster than productivity? The impact of that on external trade competitiveness can still be offset by a devaluation in the exchange rate, but there might still be important, though essentially domestic, effects. The profit share of national income could fall, and employers could face strong incentives to substitute capital for labour, reducing the employment of overpriced labour, increasing unemployment, and reducing national income below potential. The empirical question is whether these effects do actually occur. There is certainly one study which argues that they do. That study by the Italian economists Daveri and Tabellini, published by the Centre for Economic Policy Research in 1997, argued indeed that rises in the tax wedge between 1970 and 95 were a significant driver of capital labour substitution in some European countries, and as a result, a significant driver of unemployment. Indeed, to a quite striking extent, the empirical correlation findings of Daveri and Tabellini reflected what theory suggests we should expect to see, which of course is always a very exciting moment for an economist when empirical results actually confirm with theory. In common with previous studies, including some by Richard Layard and Stephen Nickell of the CEP, they found no particular correlation between high tax rates and high unemployment rates between countries at any one fixed point in time. And they found no evidence that a rise in the tax burden created unemployment in efficient labour markets. Whether that efficiency was achieved by either of the two routes which labour economists tend to think are possible, either through the flexibility and decentralisation route, such as we see in the US or the UK, or via the centralised and coordinated route, such as we see in Scandinavia. But where labour markets inefficiently combined strong trade unions but limited coordination, such as in France or Belgium, they found a real wage-resistant effect to a rising tax burden with consequences, adverse consequences for employment and growth. Which, if true, leaves us with an important special case effect, which, however, does have the following characteristics which are worth noting. First, that it is not inherently anything to do with competitiveness. It is indeed an effect which could occur in an entirely closed economy. Secondly, it's not a problem if labour markets are efficient, which is an interesting finding, because what it actually means is that the tax burden of a welfare state is more easily sustainable the more flexible your labour market. An interesting point which, as it were, combines typically left-wing and typically right-wing points of view. And the core of the problem in this case is basically a lack of consent to the tax rises, which may perhaps imply a need for greater honesty in tax systems. Given that payroll taxes are the precise economic equivalents of income taxes, and given that we should wish their effect, if we don't want to create unemployment, to fall on post-tax earnings, we are probably most likely to achieve that efficient and intended result if we are honest and impose them as income taxes, rather than trying to get away with the intransparent form of payroll taxes, which makes it slightly more likely that we will have real wage resistance effects. Finally, it is possible, indeed I think likely, that these effects are entirely a problem of change in the level of tax, not in the absolute income, that in the long term the incidence of them will fall on post-tax earnings even in less efficient labour markets. French real wages and total labour costs, for instance, have been lagging significantly behind productivity in the 1990s, having run ahead in the 1980s. perhaps a long-term unwinding of that real wage resistance effect. Special case number two is floating exchange rate irrationality, for I know what practical business people in the audience will be thinking when I glibly assert that a rise in costs can be offset by a movement in the exchange rate to produce a new equilibrium. You're thinking, well, that's all very well in theory, but it's not how the real world works. Yes, in the world of theory, the temporary disequilibrium on the left of this slide is smoothly offset by 10% devaluation to bring labour costs and productivity back into balance. But what if it doesn't? What if the exchange rate stays high and labour costs in international terms are out of kilter, too high relative to productivity? Don't we have then a competitiveness problem, even if only temporarily? To which the answer is yes, but that this has nothing to do with tax burdens. A high-taxed country could suffer this problem, and a low-taxed country could suffer it. A country raising taxes could suffer it, and a country cutting taxes could suffer it. And the exchange rate could move irrationally to make you temporarily uncompetitive, or it could move irrationally to make you super competitive. Floating exchange rates can and do act irrationally, but in relation to the arguments about tax burdens, they are just random, unbiased noise in the system. A problem, but one totally independent of tax policy, and one which does not contradict the argument that in the long term, disequilibria in the relationship between cost and productivity will tend to be offset by floating exchange rates. In which case, the real problem is more likely to be special case three, an uncompetitive position in a fixed exchange rate system. Suppose we start with two countries. One has higher total labour costs but higher productivity to match, and the higher productivity country has a 40% tax wedge, the lower productivity country a 20% one. Though note, because it's an important point, that that could have been the other way round. We could have had the higher productivity country with the lower tax wedge and vice versa. You can think of these countries as Germany and Spain if you want to put concrete illustrations on them. Then suppose that they enter monetary union and fix their exchange rates, but that for some reason they fix them not at an equilibrium exchange rate, but at parities which leave country A's total labour costs higher than sustainable given its productivity, and country B's the inverse. And this is not just a theory, or it may not just be a theory. If you read, for instance, Anatol Kaletsky's criticisms of monetary union in the Times or Martin Wolf's in the Financial Times, this is exactly the problem that they say Germany now faces. And they may be right. On the balance of payments chart presented earlier, Germany is running a small deficit despite an economy still significantly below trend. And on a cyclically adjusted basis, Germany might be in a structurally uncompetitive position at the present fixed exchange rates at which it entered EMU. And if that's true, it creates a problem of adjustment, because over some transition period, Germany would have to grow productivity but not grow total labour costs. One way to do that would be to have 5 years in which neither the proportional tax wedge nor post-tax real wages change. Another would be to reduce the tax wedge, allowing an equilibrium to be reached despite rises in real wages. And this latter option might be the more politically acceptable. For it is possible that even if the German people were quite happy with a high tax wedge and high collective provision of services before the exchange rate mistake was made, they may prefer to get out of it by cutting tax rather than by accepting no growth in post-tax real wages during the transition period. So at least theoretically and perhaps in practice, this could be an important special case, but again, with rather important characteristics. The problem is essentially created by the wrong exchange rate, not by tax. Because although the actual example given is Germany, which has reasonably high tax, it could have been the low tax country which got stuck with the high exchange rate. And indeed, in the Kaletsky version of this theory, high tax France has ended up with a super competitive low fixed parity. Thirdly, the real issue is how to constrain labour costs in a politically acceptable way. There's nothing special about the tax wedge. And fourthly, and it's an important point this, while this can be a problem for an individual country in a monetary union, it cannot be a problem for the whole currency union as a whole. Indeed, to the extent that any one country has this problem, there must be others which are in a match in sense, super competitive, total labour costs below equilibrium values. As a result, the idea that a high tax burden can create a competitiveness problem for the whole of the Eurozone, as against an individual country within it, still remains absurd. Special case four, sectorally specific effects. And here at last, we actually have an example which really does concern both competitiveness and tax. It works as follows. Suppose you introduce unilaterally, i.e. when other nations do not, an industrial energy tax with offsetting reductions in labour taxes. The result could be tax revenue neutral for the whole economy, but not for specific sectors. Energy-intensive sectors become less competitive, labour-intensive ones become more competitive. Over time, economic theory and empirical evidence tells us that a new equilibrium will be achieved. We'll export less aluminium, let us say, but export more textiles, the economy balancing out in terms of current account and in terms of employment. But it is likely that it would balance out with a slightly lower exchange rate and with less favourable terms of trade. We will have to devote more resources to the labour-intensive sectors to afford desirable imports than we previously had to devote to energy-intensive sectors. A unilateral sector-specific tax, even if revenue neutral, can therefore have a admittedly rather small prosperity effect through the terms of trade. And indeed, that is, as we noted earlier, the only way, going back to the general theory, that competitiveness considerations ever affect prosperity. This specific case, therefore, provides a strong rationale for proceeding with caution when introducing sectorally specific taxes. But it actually tells us nothing about the impact of the overall tax burden on economic success. Indeed, paradoxically, this is the only one of the four special cases which truly talks to competitiveness effects, but it is one in which the aggregate tax burden hasn't actually risen since the tax is introduced with offsetting reductions elsewhere. We are therefore left still with a robust overall conclusion. Competitiveness considerations tell us nothing about the sustainable or economically optimal size of the state. If therefore there are economic constraints on social and political choice, they must either lie in disincentives to work and save or in tax-based migration and avoidance effects. So let's turn to disincentives. Do higher taxes make people work less and save less? Well, the answer is probably and up to a point. Work first. In simple minimal state rhetoric, it is simply assumed that low taxes are economically beneficial because of incentive to work. The reality is a bit more complex, for the impact of tax on work, as is well familiar, is a product of two factors, income effects and substitution effects. Income effects are such that, all other things being equal, if you tax me in a lump sum way and reduce my income, I will actually tend to work more. Substitution effects are such that if you reduce the marginal pay post-tax that I get for any hour of work, I will tend to work more. So there are factors going either way. Theory tells us that for any individual, there are income effects going one way, substitution or marginal effects going the other. Empirical analysis then has to try to tell us the balance of those effects in practice. And as any of you who have tried to look at the literature will know, what the empirical evidence tells us is bewilderingly unclear, with a huge range of different estimates of actual real-world incentive effects. But with something like this consensus, elasticities are low for men, but they're much higher for women, particularly women with children. In terms of actual figures, you can find estimates for men ranging from negative, which would mean, perhaps counterintuitively to some, that higher taxes overall produce more work, but that's what some of the empirical results say, up to, say, plus 0.3, which means that work increases 3% if we increase post-tax income 10%. And you can find also some pretty low elasticities for women, as low as 0.1, but you'll never find them negative, but also as high as 1, which would be really quite high, meaning a 10% increase in post-tax wages produces a 10% increase in work. And it's actually quite obvious why the elasticities are higher for women with children than for men. Women with children are not trading off income versus leisure. They are trading off the benefits of money income versus the lost value of household activity, the costs of childcare, the costs of cleaning ladies, the costs of bought-in rather than prepared food, etc. And cross-elasticities of that sort will always be higher than more fundamental customer preference elasticities. So the biggest impact of cutting income tax, predicted by empirical analysis, is that more women with children will work. The other predicted impacts are very small. And this slide simply illustrates, so that we think about the scale of it, how small. If we cut the tax rate from 30% to 23%, which is a pretty big tax cut, we increase post-tax earnings by 10%. You get to keep 77%, not 70%, of your income. If the elasticity is 0.2, which is a reasonable mid-range estimate for men, that will produce a 2% one-off increase in measured GDP if there are no other offsetting effects. But clearly a tax cut of that magnitude might have offsetting effects. For instance, the public expenditure otherwise afforded on, say, education or transport infrastructure might itself have been conducive to economic growth. Given those low elasticities, therefore, any idea that there is some magical route to prosperity through cuts in tax rates from present levels is likely to be an illusion. But that can still leave you with a good argument for avoiding very high rates of income tax. For whatever you believe incentive effects are, tax cuts from very high levels must logically have much larger effects than cuts from low levels. For the incentive comes not from the tax paid, but from the pay kept after tax. As a result, a cut in tax rate from 90% to 80% should logically have the same incentive impact as one which cuts the rate all the way from 50 to 0%. Or to give a more concrete example, any flat taxer who believes that Britain would become more enterprising if we had a 30% top tax rate has to face the fact that it could only possibly produce an incentive effect 1/15th as large as that produced by the rate cuts from 83% to 40% already implemented in Britain since 1979. Cuts in tax rates, in other words, are subject to declining marginal return relative to incentive effects. It is, as a result, quite possible to believe that the reductions in very high marginal rates introduced in Britain in the 1980s and indeed throughout the world had a beneficial effect, while being totally sceptical of the belief that further cuts in Britain's top tax rate or cuts in the standard rate from 22 to 20% would have any significant economic advantage. Finally, let's look at the facts at the macro level. Do countries with a lower overall tax burden achieve higher rates of employment? Well, the answer is actually no, they don't. This slide seeks to correlate government receipts as a percentage of GDP and the employment rate for 1994 to 99 for the major developed countries. The best fit line to this scatter, for what it's worth, actually goes up the way, but it isn't worth anything because down here it points out that the R squared is 0.1%. Yes, there are high employment countries with low tax burdens, like the USA down at the bottom right, but there are also high employment countries with high tax burdens, such as Denmark and Sweden, up in the top right. And perhaps surprisingly, the reason those countries have high employment rates is that they have high female participation, directly contradicting the micro-level empirical finding that high tax rates are disincentives to female work, or perhaps illustrating that high levels of provision of nursery schooling and high levels of maternity pay, which then have to be paid for out of high taxes, can be an equally successful alternative route to encouraging female participation in the workforce. The conclusion from these figures is that the facts of economics do not remove the potential for different societies to make significantly different social choices. So much for work. Let us turn briefly to savings. More briefly, because here the story is, in a sense, if you won't mind the paradox, more straightforward because it's even less clear. There is a nice easy theory which is taught in year one economics, in which investment returns decline with increasing investment and savings increase with increasing returns, in which case lower taxes on savings will tend to increase the savings rate, moving the point of intersection with the investment schedule to the right and thus increasing investment and growth. Cut taxes on savings and people will save more. You've probably heard politicians say that lots of times. cut capital gains tax and entrepreneurs will invest more. But sadly, as a description of the real world, this is simply not true. In the real world, indeed, saving schedules can under some circumstances be either vertical or backward sloping. People save to ensure a target level of income in retirement, and if the rate of the return they can achieve falls, they often tend to invest more. When Gordon Brown removed the rather technical thing called ACT credits on dividends, which were received by dividend pension funds, which he did in his budget of 1997, he cut the rate of return earned by those pension funds. But everybody who was then responsible for running a defined benefit pension fund on behalf of employees knows that as a result, you were then instructed by your actuaries to increase the rate of contribution. Since at a lower rate of return, a higher contribution, which is a higher rate of savings on behalf of the pension plan members, is required to achieve target income. The rate of return was cut and the savings rate went up. Similarly with personal decisions. The US savings rate has not been in free fall since the 1980s because of low returns and onerous taxes on savings. It has been falling because people have made such large capital gains from share price appreciation that they do not feel the need to make further savings out of current earnings, i.e. the higher the return they have received, the less they have saved. And given these complexities of behaviour, it is not surprising that if you plot savings rates against the general burden of taxation, you get absolutely nothing. No correlation at all, whether you look here at the household savings rate or here at the gross national savings rate, which includes savings by corporations. Which still leaves us with some good reasons to avoid very high rates of tax on savings. Higher tax rates on financial savings distort relative returns between financial asset investment and real asset investment. They encourage people to put all their money into buying houses. High tax rates on investments encourage businesses to do things which are tax efficient rather than economically optimal. And there is a lot to be said socially for taxes on savings sufficiently low that even very low-risk investments deliver returns which are in real terms positive. People of modest means in particular, who have already paid tax on income, ought to be able to preserve the value of their savings without taking undue risk. So there are good social arguments for keeping the taxation of savings below a certain excessive level. There are good arguments on both income and savings taxes indeed, for moving away, as we did, from the very high rates of tax rates of 50% or more, which used to distort our system, and good reasons in general for preferring wider tax bases and lower tax rates. But there is no empirical or theoretical support for the idea that cutting tax rates from the levels we now see in Britain, cutting CGT below its current level, or the standard rate of tax on savings from, say, 20 to 10%, will unleash a surge of savings and investment. Incentive effects cannot therefore support the assertion that we need significantly to reduce the size of the effect, nor the belief that we would get richer if we did so. So if there is some economic necessity to cut taxes, it must come from this fourth category. The assertion here is that you might wish to have a tax state taxing and spending 40% of GDP, and in a closed economy that might be sustainable, but in the real world of globalization and the internet, it's not going to be possible. Is that true? Well, let's start with corporation taxes. The hypothesis is that these are going to erode for two reasons, because companies will move their legal domicile from higher tax regimes without moving real activities, and because they will move real activities, manufacturing moving, say, from high tax Britain to low tax Ireland or Brazil. Both are possible. Both might, depending on your point of view, provide a theoretical justification for the tax harmonisation proposals put forward on the first slide in the quote from Donald McIntyre. But in reality, there are very powerful factors limiting these effects. Domicile shifts are less simple than often supposed. The potential is limited to a small number of large multinationals, and while a domicile shift can save tax due to the unbelievable complexities of transfer pricing and double taxation relief, It does not change the principle and practice that if you generate profits from business in a country, you have to pay tax there. So if there is to be a major erosion of business tax bases, tens of billions of pounds, rather than 1 or 2 billions of pounds, it must come about not through domicile shifts, but through the mobility of real capital and real activities, factories and distribution centres and R&D functions actually moving. But those real activities are considerably less mobile than much of the rhetoric suggests. First, because there are many sectors of the economy which are inherently untradeable and therefore unshiftable. If you want to serve the British retailing market or the British fast food restaurant market or the car repair market, you have to operate in Britain and you have to pay taxes in Britain. You can't import retailing services. And in fact, over time, an increasing share of value added is moving to these untradable activities, to services and servicing. Second, because even if your business is shiftable manufacturing, there are factors such as the importance of economic clusters, of supply chains and just-in-time delivery, limiting the ease with which you can move. Real corporate activity is far less mobile than the sort of rhetoric of globalization and global factors of production typically suggests. And it's because of that that there is, in fact, no evidence at all that the ability of governments to raise taxes from businesses is eroding over time, whether in the European Union on the left, the UK specifically on the right, or the OECD as a whole. There is no trend. There is simply a cycle corresponding to the overall level of corporate profits. The fall on this chart between 1988 and 1994 is completely explained by falling Japanese corporate profits, and the cycle has turned up again in the late 1980s. More detailed analysis indeed finds no evidence of an erosion effect. The Institute of Fiscal Studies conducted a major investigation in 1997. It empirically tested for the proposition that open economies would have to lower their tax rates to compete and that higher capital mobility would correlate with lower taxes. It could find no evidence to support these hypotheses and no evidence that a race for the bottom was driving effective tax rates down, let alone driving them towards zero. A priori logic makes us expect to see limited rather than dramatic erosion of corporate tax bases. Empirical evidence actually reveals next to none. As for individuals migrating to avoid tax, the same conclusions apply. Of course, there must be some tax rates which induce migration of high-skilled people to lower tax regimes. But while there are frequent anecdotes, most recently in the French press on the subject of the French model Laetitia Casta, who has turned up in London, there is no robust empirical evidence which suggests that the French, Swedish, or Netherlands economies are suffering from serious brain drains as a result of top tax rates of 54, 58, and 60%. And indeed, it is striking that it is precisely on the factors of quality of workforce skills and quality of management that high tax regimes like the Netherlands and Sweden perform particularly well within the various qualitative indices of competitiveness. Finally, let me turn to the internet and consumer taxes, to that environment in which, because it is so virtual, because we will all be living on thin air and so inherently international, there must surely be a huge opportunity for tax bases to erode and disappear. This music is going to be downloaded over the net, not bought in CDs from shops. We can all do betting via offshore companies, internet-based in Jersey. Doesn't all that put the affordability of the European welfare state at risk? Well, up to a very small point. For the striking thing, when you look in detail at the present pattern of consumption taxes, is not how vulnerable they are to internet-based erosion, but how invulnerable. Earlier this year, the stock markets of America, Britain, and Europe were gripped with the delusion of the pure e-retailer. Since then, reality has set in. Except in a few information-based sectors, where the product is actually information and is therefore deliverable over the net, there's no such thing as a pure electronic retailer. What there is an internet-based searching and ordering system, which then links through to physical goods sitting in physical warehouses, which need to be physically delivered. Britain raises about 50 billion in tax revenues each year. And this central column shows where 35 billion of those 50 come from. Most of it, these 35, arise from sectors where the impact of the net on the tax base will be minimal or nil. The right-hand column gives my assessment of the potential for internet-based erosion. Let's take a few examples. Vehicles and other durables. You will certainly use the net to search for a good deal on a washing machine, but it's going to be delivered from a UK-situated warehouse, not wrapped up in a little package which comes from the States via DHL. You may use the internet, if we look at one of the biggest figures here, in order to find out about the characteristics of a restaurant or the booking for availability, but the food is not going to be downloaded. You're still going to go to the restaurant or the hotel to actually use the service. And if we turn to consider some of the other sectors accounting for 14 billion of VAT, where there's a bit greater potential for net-based erosion, and try very hard to make aggressive assumptions, you still don't come up with an erosion threat of more than a few billion pounds. And there's a fundamental reason why. The internet delivers information and delivers entertainment. So if information and entertainment had in the past been heavily taxed, the net could threaten significant tax-based erosion. But in fact, we've never in the past taxed information and entertainment very heavily, or we've taxed it in very specific ways. Information in the form of books, newspapers, and magazines has never been taxed at all. In Britain, at least, it is zero rated for tax. So you can buy as many books as you like from Amazon.com and buy them off the US system so they come VAT free. It doesn't make the slightest bit of difference to Gordon Brown's revenues. As for entertainment, we effectively tax it in a rather interesting way. You pay for commercial television services by buying the soap powder and the cars which are advertised on ITV. You pay your VAT on ITV services through the VAT you pay on soap powder and cars. So that if advertising is going to continue to be a major source of the revenue which supports information and entertainment provision over the net, which I am sure it will, you will go on paying tax on internet services through the VAT you pay on the physical goods which are advertised. We chatter on about the virtual world living on thin air, but our tax base is already to a great extent based either on labour costs or on physical goods and assets whose taxability is not eroded by the existence of the net. Yes, betting levies may be vulnerable to net-based erosion. Betting levies account for 1.5 billion of revenue. Fuel duties account for 23 billion of revenue. Property stamp duties, which are rising sharply, account for 5 billion. Council tax and business rates, British property taxes, for 28 billion. There will be some erosion effects, but not so much that it cannot be offset by a judicious further rebalancing of tax bases in the direction still further of physical goods and real property. So that overall, on this tax base erosion issue, yes, there will be some erosion and some need to rebalance, but the idea that erosion will be so great as to require a wholesale dismantling of European welfare states is, I suggest, wishful thinking on the right wing and a quite unnecessary nightmare on the left. Summing up, therefore, across the four constraints, we are left with the following assessment. Global capital markets and competitiveness are largely red herrings. Real wage resistance, which should really have been a separate category from competitiveness, could, in important specific circumstances and in transition, in the case of rising tax wedges, be important. Incentive issues argue for avoiding very high rates. They push us in favour of wide tax bases and lower rates. Migration and internet issues are important up to a point, but a fairly small one. And that conclusion can be tested also at a macro correlation level. Let's forget all the theoretical and micro level empirical arguments. Let's just plot growth per capita against the size of the state. These are the figures for developed economies for the period 1960 to 1995. There isn't much of a correlation. The best fit line is a gentle downward slope, but the R squared is just 3%, and it's one of those wonderful correlations which depends on one observation only, Japan, which at that period was both low tax and very high growth. Indeed, take out Japan and you can have an equally statistically insignificant upward slope. Repeat the exercise for 1994 to 1999 and you get the same lack of correlation, and again with one interesting outlier. In this case, it is Ireland, low tax and high growth. Because of Ireland, the best fit line is mildly down, but with no statistical power. Take Ireland out, and the line slopes up. But again, that is driven by one point, which is Finland, that point there, which has been doing extremely well over the last 6 years, but which, again, is a largely unfair figure because it's been bouncing back from a deep recession. You are in one of those environments where you can, if you want, play, well, this is a special case and that is a special case, but the most reasonable assumption is there is very little correlation there. Yes, there are currently low tax, high growth success stories, the US and Australia, which are here and here, but there is also a low tax, low growth disaster, which is Japan, and there are high tax, high growth successes, Finland, Sweden, and the Netherlands. Theory and microanalysis lead us to expect some economic penalty from a state above some level. In the macro correlations, it is difficult even to see the mild effect which we would expect. Leaving us, I'm afraid, with no precise determined guidelines on the size of the state, but the need for judgment amid great uncertainty. And I'd like to suggest the following reasonable judgments for debate. There has to be some level of tax burden which must harm economic dynamism. And that level probably varies with language and culture. The danger of high-skill migration to the US, for instance, is likely to be higher in an English-speaking country than in a French-speaking country. But there is a wide range of levels across which the choices which societies make have only limited implications for economic performance. Probably, and this is where it gets really judgmental, probably above about 45%, you begin to enter some sort of danger zone. And European countries above that level, I suspect, will head towards it. Though I have to admit that I'm relying here on an a priori belief in incentive and migration effects, not on the macro correlations, which could suggest a higher level. But I can see no a priori logic or empirical evidence to suggest that a reduction below 40% will give a benefit, even if it might be desirable for other reasons. Societies are therefore, to a far greater extent than the three open quotations suggested, free to choose the size of the state they want. They are not constrained to a given size by the external economic realities of technology, globalization, and competition, nor by the relentless economic logic of incentives to work and save. Instead, what they are constrained by are essentially internal factors to do with popular consent and popular preference. The best argument for reducing the size of the French state is not that it will deliver some magic economic benefit, but that opinion polls show that French people, unlike British people asked the same questions, express a preference for tax cuts over public expenditure increases, given their present starting point at about 52% of GDP. There is not a major issue of internet-based tax erosion or tax bases. Our tax bases are in technical terms fairly robust because they are primarily physical, but there is a political issue about whether we are going to continue to be able to convince people that higher fuel duties are politically acceptable. There is not a major problem of tax-based migration caused by the footloose mobility of corporate capital using the intricate techniques of the virtual world, but there is evidence that the size of the black economy has been growing and growing faster in high-tax countries through the operation of such traditional and well-familiar effects as the plumber who would really rather prefer cash and the self-employed construction worker who just happens to have been working for the same employer for the last decade. And there is a reasonable prima facie hypothesis that the reason why structural rather than cyclical budget deficits emerged in most European countries in the 1980s and 90s was that governments had pushed expenditure levels beyond those which commanded general consent. Where consent and support is clear, governments have the honesty and courage to fund expenditure with tax. When they are pushing beyond the limits of acceptable tax, they tend to use debt finance, throwing the burden onto future generations. What is striking, therefore, is the disconnect between the terms in which the tax debate is often conducted and the real issues which could concern us. Degrees of freedom are widely believed to be restricted by external economic constraints. But the real issues created by high and rising tax burdens, at least when we are talking about a few points or so of variation around Britain's current 40% level, are whether there is popular support, whether there will be real wage resistance, and whether, in order to make sure that there isn't, governments are willing to be honest about the intended effects of higher tax, and old-fashioned, low-tech, rather than high-tech, tax avoidance. And the vital need is for honest tax debates, which increase the likelihood of support for whatever level we choose by facing people with the choices that they are able collectively to make. At the next British election, there will probably be a significant choice between policies of lower tax and those of higher government expenditure. And there are good arguments, good political arguments, about the balance of individual choice versus collective aspiration to be made on either side of that debate. But the debate should be conducted on those terms, a choice which it is largely ours to make, rather than one constrained by some external economic necessity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Adair. There were lots of challenging arguments in that talk, which I'm sure some people would like to perhaps take issue with or support, as the case may be. I think we have about 10 minutes for questions, so who would like to ask a question? Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that a lot of people, like myself, have many, many questions which you managed to answer as you went through your speech. I would say that the one thing that struck me as you were going through is it necessary to cut taxes? I believe in some ways is the wrong question, and politicians should be continually justifying to us why they need as much as they're taking at the moment. I would say on the debt finance thing, just to bring up one of the points that I've jotted down, when the tax is not fully supported, of course this government has shown the other way to do that, which is through a variety of stealth taxes. And you mentioned in passing the removal of the ACT, and then also on the defined contribution versus defined benefit. And on defined contribution, of course, you have a lot of trustees who know what they're doing. Unfortunately, most of us are sitting on defined benefit, and people are completely unaware that the government has stolen their pension from them. And is that a really responsible thing for the government to be doing? Well, I don't believe so, but it's electorally very expedient.
Well, can I say I think I agree with that? I mean, what I'm saying is the real issues about tax are political. The real issues about tax are what you want, about whether we're getting value for money for it, whether it corresponds to the choices that people want in relation to the balance between individual income and collective provision. And it is in those terms that the debate should really be put forward. I think in relation to stealth taxes, you're quite right. The ACT tax was, in some ways, the most brilliant stealth tax of all times, because what Gordon Brown spotted was it was a golden opportunity to stand up and declare that he had abolished a tax, the net effect of which was to make him £5 billion better off. It is very rare, and it relies upon the particular technical oddities of ACT, that a Chancellor can raise more tax revenue by abolishing a tax.
Given the failure of the social welfare system to tackle social exclusion, how would you convince people to support high rates of tax?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's various logical loops in your question. I mean, if you're saying, given that there is a failure of the social welfare system to tackle social exclusion, a school of thought could draw from that the conclusion that redistributing through transfer payments is not the way to deal with social exclusion, therefore you don't need high taxes. I mean, that could be one inference of what you said. I mean, you could have started with your sentence and said, given the failure of the social welfare system to deal with social exclusion, doesn't this prove that a lot of this tax is completely wasted? Now, I don't happen to believe that. I think that if we're going to address the issues of social exclusion, there are a lot of complicated issues involved. They're to do with education, they're to do with the opportunities for work that people have. But I certainly do not exclude the fact that one element of it
must be some element of old-fashioned redistribution. I mean, I am actually a market liberal, but I call myself a redistributive market liberal. I therefore am in favour of the working family tax credit, not because I actually think it's going to produce some magic incentives to work. I think the stuff that I put forward on incentives to work should throw some doubt upon the idea that people are going to work harder because of the working family tax credit. Indeed, it's quite possible that at that level of income, the income effects will outweigh the substitution effects, and that people won't work harder at all. But I think if you are a market liberal and you are arguing, as I would, for minimum wages either not to exist or to be set at fairly low levels in order to avoid the creation of unemployment through interventions in the labour market, the quid pro quo of that, at least to me, is that you have to have an alternative mechanism to provide adequate income, and that is why I have always believed in things like negative income taxes or working family tax credits, whatever you call them. And in order to pay for those, you've got to have a higher, an element of redistributed taxes on people of higher income level. How would you persuade people of that? Well, that is the challenge of politics. I guess what I'm saying is, you're most likely to do it if you're honest and straightforward. I mean, we will see what the nature of the debate is at the next time round. But the final thing I would say on that is, I think a myth grew up in Britain after the 1992 election that said, although people reply to opinion polls saying that they want a slightly higher tax level and a slightly higher public expenditure, they're lying to themselves, and when they get into the booth, they vote the other way. I don't think that is the right conclusion of 1992. I think what happened in 1992 was people said, quite truly, and I think they did truly want a bit more tax and a bit more public expenditure, and they got offered the ludicrous proposition that incomes above not a very high level were going to go from a 40% tax rate to a 59% tax rate. And it's quite possible that there is a constituency which is willing to accept a 1 or 2 or 3% increase in tax revenues, but is completely unwilling to accept a 19% increase in tax rates. And I think that's a perfectly logical and reasonable point of view for people to have.
Do you think that it's possible to apply these economic measures to the developing countries, such as Latin America?
I said earlier that I was very aware that my comments were primarily focused on developed, rich, stable economies. And I said that particularly in relation to my comments about global capital markets, that global capital markets in relation to Sweden versus the US have no point of view on tax and spend level. They only have a point of view on the sustainability of the finance and the balance between the two. I think in relation to emerging countries, in principle, it is the same. In principle, it is the same. And an interesting giveaway of that is if you compare Poland and Russia over the last 10 years, Russia is the darling of, Poland is the darling success of the transformation to a market economy. Russia is the disaster. Poland can begin to raise money in global bond markets. Russia can't dream of it. Poland has had throughout that period tax and spend stable at about 45% of GDP. Russia has had a collapsing level of spend and an even more collapsing level of tax. And I think what you can take from that is that the institutions of global capitalism, even in those circumstances, are interested in the sustainability rather than the absolute level. They weren't worried that the Russian state had too low a tax and spend level. They were simply worried that the Russian state was completely incapable of raising even a low level of tax. And that's why the Russian state eventually defaulted on its bonds in 1998. I think what is the case is that it is very difficult in many emerging countries to realistically sustain, for essentially internal reasons, not external reasons, more than a 20 or a 25% or maybe a 30% level of taxes percent of GDP. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. I mean, if you still have a large agricultural sector, which is still you know, I mean, it's more like India than Brazil, but if you have a large agricultural sector which is still to a degree subsistence, it is almost impossible and indeed undesirable to tax that on an income basis. Therefore, there tends to be, over quite a range of incomes, a bit of a correlation between income level and tax level. The size of the state has tended to go up with the prosperity level of economies, and I think there are some natural features why that is so. I guess what I would say, though, is I would stick to the point that fundamentally in relation to Brazil, global capital markets' interest is in the sustainability of whatever is the relationship between spend and tax, that they have no a priori fixation in their observed behavior with that level of tax being X or Y. They're interested with the relationship and the sustainability thereof.
I've read and heard several times that Britain takes a disproportionately large share of foreign direct investment into the EU, and presumably, all else being equal, this is a good thing. Britain is also one of the least taxed countries in the EU. Do you see any strong connection between the two, and if so, what implication does this have for the notion that the absolute level of tax is relatively unimportant?
Well, 2 points. First, in terms of corporate tax, business tax, the UK is about the highest taxed in Europe. You may have seen as the slide went through, as a percent of GDP, UK government now takes about 4% of GDP in corporation taxes versus European average of about 2.8 and versus German and French levels of about 1.5 or 2. And that is because of the very clever tax reforms which Nigel Lawson put through, which were those classic reforms which cut tax rates and widened tax bases to the extent that he increased the effective tax rate. And the effective business tax rate, despite all that you hear, has for many years been significantly higher in the UK than it is in Germany, because the German system has had high marginal tax rates but tons and tons of deductions. So certainly you cannot say that a business rate taxation temptation has been the route which has attracted inward investment to the UK. If you then go back to the issue of labour rates of tax, I think I go back to the slides that I showed that said, once you think about tax incidence theory, and once you think with floating exchange rates, I think it simply cannot be the case that by having a lower rate of tax, you have lowered your total labour cost, even domestically, let alone in international comparative terms. And therefore, I don't think it is the case that that is the reason. I think the reasons are twofold. One, I think it's catch-up. Britain 20 years ago, even a bit today, was a less rich and less productive country than Germany or France. Had a lower rate of productivity, had a lower per capita GDP, and it therefore had a lower total labour cost, because, you know, economics does work. Total labour cost tends to sort of get driven to an equalisation with productivity. In a world of internationally mobile capital and internationally mobile ideas and management skill, the existence of a country geographically close to attractive markets, which has, to start with, a lower labour cost and a lower level of productivity, is tremendously tempting. Because if by the transfer of technique, management know-how and skill, you can combine that lower labour cost with a world-class rather than domestic level of productivity, then you will achieve a very attractive result. I think that was the single most important factor and the driving factor. I think then there are another set of factors. I think flexibility of the labour markets, not in relation to a low level of wage, but in terms of the ease of reorganisation of factories was attractive. And I think finally, don't forget the English language. If you talk to a major Japanese investor about where they invest, because I have done this in Germany, we ended up putting the corporate tax headquarters, the corporate headquarters for Germany, in Düsseldorf. Why did we put it in Düsseldorf? Because it had more direct flights and because it had a Japanese school. Why do corporate headquarters tend to come to London? because large numbers of Japanese executives speak at least reasonable English, and very, very few speak reasonable French or German. Those factors which are to do with the manageability of the investment for the senior executives and the corporate relationships are far more significant than is typically allowed for in mechanically driven, tax-driven or whatever accounts of investment flows.
I know we could go on for longer, but I'm afraid we have to draw the proceedings to a close. So I would like to thank Adair for giving us a really excellent presentation with lots of food for thought.